It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you updated on the news that made headlines this week. A lot to get to. And our panel today, Clark Corbin with Idaho Capital Sun, Mia Maldonado, state's politics reporter with Idaho Capital Sun, James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News, Sydney Kidd with BoiseDev.com, and Murphy Woodhouse, Mountain West News Bureau reporter with Boise State Public Radio News. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
Happy Indeed. Friday.
Hello.
So I want to begin with what's going on at the legislature. So Jimmy and Mia, I know both of you have been covering this. Lawmakers put a bill forward that would bring back a committee that studies what happens when pregnant people die in Idaho. So Jimmy, I want to start with you because what happened to the old committee?
Well, I mean, basically it just expired. It had a provision in the law that the committee was set to sunset last year. And, you know, barring any sort of, intervention by the legislature, it was going to do so. And they chose not to do anything or extend that deadline last year, for which they got a hefty amount of criticism for, since that made Idaho the only state in the country to not have an official panel reviewing these maternal mortality figures. So now you have a new bill introduced earlier this week that would put that under the Board of Medicine. You know, you have House Majority Leader Megan Blanksma, who sponsors that bill, saying that the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare is still collecting that data, despite the previous version of the committee having, you know, sunsetted and is no longer around, but they're still collecting that data. And so she envisions this new entity under the Board of Medicine being able to take that data and then issue reports into the future to the legislature and the public.
So Jimmy, as you said, health and welfare, they're still gathering the data, but really there's no committee that can take that data and actually do something with it?
Not currently, no. And that's important because, as the Idaho Capital Sun actually reported last year, there was a group that found that maternal mortality kind of spiked in, I believe it was 2021, from 40.1 deaths per 100,000 births, up from 18.1 deaths per 100,000 births in 2020. So that figure is kind of shocking. In real number terms, it's only a handful of extra deaths, but that's someone's family member. It's not a significant or an insignificant loss to those people at all.
So, Mia, I want to bring you into the conversation. As Jimmy mentioned, your organization was reporting on this and that you did see that steady increase. But when you looked at the committee, Mia, when there still was one, talk to us about what you found out.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. So between 2018 and 2021, like Jimmy mentioned, there was the Maternal Mortality Review Committee noticed that there was an increase in deaths among pregnant women and new mothers in Idaho. There were 11 maternal deaths in 2020, which is up from 5 deaths in 2019 and 10 in 2018. This committee, it served a function for learning and preventing future maternal deaths, and having those numbers publicly available was useful. And so since that committee is no longer in place, there's really no publicly available data that looks into the, Idaho maternal death rates.
So Jimmy, I'm curious then, potentially another aspect to this, and that is that we now have a very strict abortion ban in place here in Idaho. Has there been like any discussion when they've brought up the possibility of having this maternal review board put back in place on how this abortion ban could impact that?
We haven't yet. The bill was just introduced earlier this week and hasn't had a public hearing yet. I fully expect that would be part of the conversation, especially from Democratic lawmakers on the House Health and Welfare Committee. And of course, when it gets to the floor, if it does, because you're right, that was a big part of the criticism for, letting that committee lapse and expire last year. Just that, we want to have eyes on the health of expecting mothers and new mothers, just to make sure that we know exactly what's going on. Another component to that is there have been attempts to expand Medicaid coverage for up to a year for new mothers, which so far has not passed the Idaho House or the Idaho legislature in general.
Mm-hmm.
But most other states do have that length of coverage for new mothers in the country. So, you know, there are so many facets to this particular issue that is just fascinating.
Yeah. So, Clark, I want to stay with the legislature, but let's talk budget. In particular, the Budget Committee seems to be playing a little bit of hardball with the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare. So, Clark, is it actually true that lawmakers zeroed out their health and welfare's budget?
Yeah, Jim, it's true. The conversation isn't over yet, and so there's still time to take it up before the end of the year. But you're exactly right. On Friday of last week, the legislature's budget committee, which we call JFAC, the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee, threatened to zero out all of the funding for the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare. It's basically their central administrative hub. So they're zeroing out funding for the director's office, for IT support, for HR, for next year's budget that would kick in July 1st. And the idea is that this is a negotiation tactic attempting to force the Department of Health and Welfare to respond to some audit findings that were critical of the Department of Health and Welfare and its grant programs for children. This audit was conducted last year. It was authorized by the legislature, by JFAC, and the Legislative Services Office carried out the audit. And what it found was, it found a number of findings, including that the department did not have adequate controls in place and documentation for its grant funding program. Initially, under previous director Dave Jepson, before he retired, the department said it disagreed with all of the audit findings. The former director retired at the end of the year or in early January this year. And there's a new interim director in place, Dean Cameron, former state senator, former chair of JFAC himself. And he has pledged to comply with the audit, to get answers to the legislators. But on Monday, the legislature went ahead and followed through with zeroing out the funding for the next budget year for the Department of Health and Welfare's administrative hub. And what they're saying is that if before the legislature adjourns, which we think will likely be in late March, although there's no exact set deadline to adjourn, if the legislature gets the audit findings corrected by the Department of Health and Welfare before they adjourn for the year, then the legislature and JFAC would consider taking up the funding for the administrative hub. It's definitely a negotiation tactic. They're playing a little bit of hardball. You can kind of look at it as they're taking this element of the department's budget hostage in order to kind of force a response. And it's one of several budget changes that JFAC is implementing this year that are completely transforming and changing the budget process. But right off the bat, we've seen big changes. And you're absolutely right, playing a little bit of hardball because the legislature was not happy and did not accept the fact that the department initially denied and basically said it disagreed with these audit findings. And so it's kind of an ongoing feud between legislators and the department that was escalated a little bit with this budget pressure. And so it's a pretty new development. There absolutely is still an opportunity for them to take up the funding request before the legislature adjourns. But Keith Bybee, one of the budget managers for the state of Idaho, said that if they don't have this funding, it would be very, very hard for the department to operate moving forward. So we've got a real showdown between some legislators on the budget committee and the Department of Health and Welfare playing out right now, Gemma.
So, Clark, how much money are we talking about?
I think it was almost $50 million is what we're talking about. That's a small overall percentage of the health and welfare budgets, especially when you think about the Medicaid budget. But I think it's about $50 million for all of these office functions, IT, HR, and then funding for the director's office itself. So I think it's just under $50 million.
Okay. Cindy, I want to bring you into the conversation because some pretty big news coming out of the health sector, and that is that Salter Medical Group is going to be shutting down, I guess, unless they can find a buyer. So what's going on here?
Yeah, so yesterday the news came out. The Statesman reported it first, but Boise Dev's Dawn Day also reported this, that Salter Health said that if they can't find a buyer by March 29th, they're shutting everything down. And this is a pretty big deal because Salter has about a dozen locations in Ada and Canyon counties, and it would impact approximately 100,000 patients and 400 employees. Mm. It's a big deal.
Yeah, it really is. Okay, so we just have to wait then and see if a buyer comes through.
Yeah, so Salter said that they're pretty confident that they'll find a buyer, but they've had kind of an interesting history of ownership. They opened in 1961 as an independent healthcare provider. And then in 2012, they came to an agreement with St. Luke's for St. Luke's mm-hmm. to purchase it. But a judge actually blocked that sale because he said that it would create a healthcare monopoly. In 2019, Ball Ventures Ahlquist actually bought Salter Health before selling it to Intermountain, which is a Utah-based healthcare system, about a year later. So Intermountain owns it right now. They're trying to find a seller, and if they can't, then Salter Health's just gonna go away.
Wow. Okay. Thanks for that update. So, Jimmy, my understanding is that lawmakers shelved the library bill, at least for now. So, can you tell us what was in the bill and why they decided to put it on the shelf?
Yeah, so this latest iteration is pretty similar to last year's version, where if someone who objects to a particular piece of material, whether it's a book or a movie or a magazine, in a public or private library, we should note it would apply to private school libraries as well, that they could basically tell the library administration, I want that moved to an adults-only section. And the library would have to do that within 30 days, or they could be subject to a lawsuit. And with that lawsuit, they could face a fine of $250. And the person who sued could also receive uncapped damages for any sort of like mental anguish or whatever else that they might have experienced by seeing that material.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry, Jimmy.
Oh, no, go ahead.
So I was going to ask, okay, so right now then, could a book still be in the library if it was deemed inappropriate?
Well, I mean, it depends on each individual library's particular policies. So some, public libraries have a policy where, you know, someone can complain to the library board, say, hey, I don't think that this is, something that should be available at all, or to, just children, whatever it happens to be. And then a lot of times library boards will, have a committee, or at least like the executive director of a library and a couple other people read that particular book or whatever it is. And then they'll get together and say, yeah, okay, maybe this isn't something that should be available in this particular section. Or they could say, yeah, no, they're totally right. We need to get rid of it. And of course, they always have the option of just saying, no, we think that this has, literary value, that it should stick around and should be available to everyone, which is something that, supporters of this bill really don't like, because we've heard it over and over for the past few years that, they'll try to use these avenues to complain about a particular book or set of books, and then the library, just rejects it, which they find completely, unacceptable. Mm-hmm. So, again, it depends on every library, as to your point. But the thing with this particular bill is that it would not give libraries any sort of choice. There's no discretion. They would just have to do it or be subject to a lawsuit. We don't exactly know why it got pulled back, aside from that negotiations are ongoing between the House sponsor, Representative Jaron Crane from Nampa, and Senator Jeff Schroeder from Mountain Home, both of whom are Republicans. Senator Schroeder actually voted against last year's bill that got vetoed by the governor. And his big criticism back then was just, he didn't want what he and a lot of other critics, you know, considered kind of a bounty system where someone could just go library to library and sue them for significant amounts of money, potentially bankrupting them in the process. So I emailed and called both of them yesterday. They did get back to me, but declined to give any sort of details as to what, you know, might be negotiated on, what could actually be in the final draft of the bill, nor did they kind of have an expectation of when that might come out.
But I would assume, Jimmy, there's going to be another bill around this coming out. This is not the end of the story on this.
No, of course not. I mean, it's only January. We have plenty of time for something like this to make its way through the system.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, we will continue to see how this all plays out. Murphy, you have been doing a lot of wildfire reporting. So I'm curious about what you've been learning in terms of prescribed fires and what are some of the management implications of this?
Yeah, I've been learning a lot about prescribed fire of late. So I guess just to kind of lay the table, you know, there's a pretty strong consensus about the importance of prescribed fire and other forest management tools as a way to reduce the risk of catastrophic wildfires. And then because wildfire is such a cornerstone in many Western ecosystems, there are, of course, a lot of ecological benefits. And I do think it's always important to recognize as well that many indigenous peoples have used fire in such ways since time immemorial. But, you know, just in terms of the fire threat, just to give a sense of those benefits, you know, I reported last November on another study that found that prescribed fires and other low intensity burns substantially reduce the risk of intense burns as much as 60% and for as long as 5 or 6 years. However, prescribed fire, it's still fire, still gives off smoke, obviously. And, you know, in recent years, we've been learning a lot about the significant health effects of wildfire smoke. It makes asthma worse, lots of cardiovascular issues, et cetera. And so this question of the comparative health risks of prescribed fire versus wildfire, it's a very live one in the literature. And a recent paper that I reported on took that question on, and it kind of at least one of the big questions was whether prescribed burning and other management practices can reduce overall population exposure to wildfire smoke. The short answer is yes, but how they went about answering the question is pretty interesting. So they looked at 6 actual proposed management scenarios for a huge swath of the Central Sierra in California. I think they did it in hectares, and I'm always bad at that conversion, but I think it's a couple million acres. Two of the scenarios, which what they called minimal management and business as usual, they featured no prescribed fire and less overall interventions of other kind, like fuels reduction, et cetera. And then the remaining 4 had increasing levels of prescribed fire and other management practices. So I won't pretend to understand the math or models that they used, but the big takeaway finding is that they found that scenarios with moderate levels of burning, prescribed burning specifically, can reduce the mm-hmm. smoke exposure and associated asthma-related health impacts in the surrounding area. That benefit does appear to decline as more acres are treated with prescribed fire, but even the scenario with the most intense prescribed fire appears to be less harmful than the scenarios with no prescribed fire. And as the lead author, Claire Scholart, told me, quote, if we do even less management than we do now, things get worse from a smoke perspective. So the basic takeaway, as I understood it, is yes, prescribed fire means fewer smoke and associated health impacts. It does have those impacts, but on the whole, it means less of both of them in the long run.
Sorry to kind of get to the
management implications, which I think are kind of the key thing here. So Claire was clear that the specifics or the results that they had were specific to the landscape that they studied, but that the methodology they developed could very easily, or not maybe not easily, but certainly could be applied to broader landscapes or other landscapes across the West. And she thinks that work like hers could address some of the barriers to prescribed burning, regulations and public concerns about the practice. But I think what she really emphasized to me was that research like this, it helps managers and the public better understand the specific impacts of prescribed burning. And I think more importantly than that, how to prepare for those. And, you know, given that prescribed fire is really being looked to as one of the key components of addressing the wildfire crisis. And I mean, just to cite one example of that, a recent federal commission, major commission, dozens of members, well over 100 consensus findings. One of the major ones was, you know, we need to find ways to put more beneficial fire on the ground. And I think that just really underlines the importance of research like this that just gives us a better idea of what that will mean if we do so.
And Murphy, what about this major piece of recreation legislation that took a step forward this week? What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. So that was the Explore Act, and it was voted out of the U.S. House and Natural Resources Committee by unanimous consent. There is a companion measure in the Senate. They're not identical, but they're very close in language. That made it out of its committee last summer, both of them with broad bipartisan support. And the Explore Act, it would do quite a number of things. It's kind of it's a very long list, kind of hard to summarize, but I'll just kind of highlight some to give listeners a sense of just kind of the breadth of it. It would ease the permitting process for guides and outfitters. It would incentivize the building of long distance bike trails, allow for the online purchase of park passes, including annual passes. I'm sure many listeners out there have the experience of having to go to the little entrance booths to get their annual parks pass. It seems like that may be not long for this world. It seeks to improve access for those with disabilities as well as for military veterans. And then also will allow climbers to use fixed anchors in wilderness areas. So, I mean, just that list, I think, illustrates just, I mean, it's kind of all over the map, lots and lots of changes. And I spoke with Jessica Turner, who's the head of the Outdoor Recreation Roundtable, which represents recreation businesses. And she summarized the impacts, saying that it updates antiquated procedures, but then also could just be a real boon to the recreation business, as well as, you know, just the public's right to enjoy their public lands.
Okay, thanks for that update. Hey, Clark, I want to go back to the legislature for a minute, because there's a new bill that would let the state ask for the death penalty for people convicted of lewd conduct with a minor under 12.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Gemma. It's House Bill 405. It was just introduced on Wednesday afternoon. And this is one that it's really early in the process, and I can't quite say for sure whether this is a bill that is destined to go through the process and make it into law, or whether this is a bill that was put forward in an election year to drum up a bunch of conversation and debate. But at any rate, we do have House Bill 405 that was introduced on Wednesday, and what it would do is amend two different sections of existing law, like you said, to allow the state of Idaho to seek capital punishment, to seek the death penalty for people who are convicted of lewd conduct with a minor under 12 years old when they're aggravating circumstances. That would be a big departure from existing state law, where only first degree murder is the only crime that's punishable by the death penalty in Idaho. And I want to give a shout out to my friend Ruth Brown from Idaho Reports. She was at this hearing with me on Wednesday, and she also covered it for Idaho Reports. And Ruth pointed out that in the state of Idaho, there are hundreds of lewd conduct with a minor charges filed every year. And Ruth also reported on a U.S. Supreme Court case out of, I believe, the state of Louisiana, that found the use of the death penalty in this case for rape in Louisiana was unconstitutional. And the Supreme Court had ruled that the death penalty is really only allowable for cases of murder or cases against the state, something like terrorism. And so it was just the introductory hearing of this bill on Wednesday. So it's the very beginning of the bill's journey. It hasn't had a public hearing yet. It hasn't gone to the floor of the House for a vote yet, but this was kind of an unusual new bill, and I wanted to make note of it because the death penalty is, as you and the listeners know, has been in the news in the state of Idaho recently. Mm-hmm. There are 8 individuals in Idaho on death row, and the state has recently obtained the chemicals to carry out a lethal injection. And then last year, the state added the firing squad as a method of capital punishment execution. So the death penalty has been in the news in the state of Idaho and is likely going to continue to be in the news. I'm not sure what's in store for this bill. The hearing on Wednesday was very quiet. There was no public testimony because it was just an introductory hearing. And the sponsors really did not explain where the bill came from or take any serious debate or any questions. So we'll keep an eye on that and see if that does go before the House Judiciary Rules and Administration Committee for a public hearing or a vote. But Jemma, that was an unusual new bill, and I know we wanted mm-hmm. to make note of it and let the public be aware of it, at least at this point. But the very beginning of its journey, Jemma, to be sure.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for that. Mia, before we head to break, I want to talk with you about a story you've been covering, because you've been talking with folks in Emmett, finding out there are hundreds of people who have cancer. So why did Congress cut Idaho out of the Downwinders bill? Because is it true that we have 4 of the top 5 counties in the country that were most impacted by this type of fallout?
Hi, yes. So I recently did a story on RECA, which stands for the Radioactive Exposure Compensation Act. And it's been in the works for decades. Idaho's U.S. Congressman Mike Crapo has really been spearheading those efforts to increase expansion to people that can prove that they've had cancer and have lived in Idaho after nuclear fallout came downwind from testing in Nevada. And so this is legislation that's been in the works for decades, and yet it just still does not have enough support in U.S. Congress to pass, even though this year was the closest that it's gotten in the legislative process in U.S. Congress. And yes, it is true. So it's Gem County, along with Custer, Blaine, and Lemhi counties are among the top 5 in the U.S. that were most affected by fallout from Nevada's nuclear tests in the mid-20th century. And in my story, I interviewed a woman, Tona Henderson. She's the director of the Idaho Downwinders, and she leads a group of people who can show that they have family members and friends that lived in Gem County at the time and that had certain types of cancer. And what I'd like to highlight is a lot, these counties that have people with high rates of cancer, a lot of them are dairy communities in Idaho. And Tona, the woman I interviewed, said that she believes, her parents both had cancer, her 2 older brothers both had cancer, and they were alive at the time of nuclear testing in Nevada. And she thinks it's because of the milk that they were drinking. And a lot of cows in these areas, they were, eating the grass that had iodine-131, which is a radioactive element that's released into the environment during nuclear testing. So it's a big issue across the country. Idaho is not the only state that was impacted by nuclear testing, but it does certainly come to a surprise to some folks that, see Emmett, know Emmett as this small rural community, but they really don't maybe associate it with this dark history that it has.
Yeah, I have to say I was very surprised when I read the article. Very good reporting on that, Mia. Clark, I know you have to run, so I wanted to just talk about one more thing you've been covering this week at the legislature, and this is about AI and the fact that lawmakers have a couple of new bills out, and this is about their concerns over AI. So can you start with the one that would cover the use of misleading AI in political and election messages and how that would work?
Yeah, absolutely. Two new bills that I'm following that have to do with AI or artificial intelligence. I think since OpenAI released ChatGPT in November 2022, that's really kind of been a game changer in terms of the public's awareness of AI, but also the public's awareness of the sophistication of AI. And that's what some of these bills are going to be looking at in the Idaho legislature. But let's talk first about House Bill 407. It was just introduced, and it's a bipartisan bill that has House Minority Leader Ilana Rubel, a Boise Democrat, working with Representative Bruce Skog, a Nampa Republican. And what it would do is that it would give candidates the ability to seek relief and to ask for to block the publishing of any materials like a photo, a video, or a speech recording that manipulates a candidate for office in a way to basically completely distort their message. And when Representative Rubel introduced the bill yesterday, she talked about the concerns with, I think, basically confusing the public or misleading the public when it comes to elections, when it comes to candidates for office. And so what Representative Rubel told this committee of legislators yesterday was that the technology is really pretty stunning in what it can do to replicate a person's speech, appearance, and voice to the point where somebody could create a video of you speaking that would deceive your own mother. That's how Representative Rubel described it to the committee yesterday. She's obviously concerned that this could be used to completely mislead people when it comes to an election. And so that bill was just introduced. It's at the very start of its legislative journey. But that was one that I wanted to point out for sure, Gemma.
Okay. And then what is this other one, Clark, in regards to this is sexually explicit images or videos, but they were AI generated.
Yep, that's exactly right. That's the other AI bill this year. That's House Bill 391, I believe. And what that does is that makes it illegal to use AI-generated materials like a photo or a video to use sexually explicit AI materials to depict a real person. It makes that illegal to harass or threaten or intimidate or embarrass them through sexually explicit AI materials that are intended to depict a real person. It also makes it illegal to seek money in exchange for not publishing those materials. And so that's House Bill 391. I think that we're going to see a lot more of states across the country, of the Idaho legislature and of Congress taking a look at artificial intelligence and AI materials. And so these are kind of the first two bills that I noticed in the state of Idaho. Going to continue to cover them in the Idaho Capital Sun as long as they stay alive and make their journey through the legislative process. But I expect more AI bills in Idaho and all across the country. And these were just the first two that I saw in the first 2 weeks of this legislative session, Gemma.
Okay, appreciate those updates. And as I said, Clark, I know you have to run. So thanks for making time for us today. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Always fun to be here. Thanks.
So, Jimmy, lawmakers turned down a bill that would have set the minimum age for prosecuting a child at 10 years old. So a couple of questions about this. Why set the age at 10? But also, why did they turn it down?
Yeah. So Idaho currently doesn't have a minimum prosecution age for anyone. You know, you can prosecute anyone, you know, as young as you want here in Idaho. So the reason they set that at 10 is because that's generally been the age that states that do have this sort of provision have generally come to a consensus on. Even though some interest groups who are promoting these sorts of laws have said that, you know, internationally that age is closer to 14, basically saying that research shows that, you know, children this young, or at least at some point, just don't really have the brain development necessary to understand the consequences of their actions, nor like the actual like effect, you know, that they can't be criminally culpable for it, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that, you know, a lot of lawmakers on the House Judiciary and Rules Committee earlier this week, you know, said that they understood that, they appreciate that. Not too many of them who voted against this bill just straight up said, no, there need to be consequences for everyone and for their actions. Mostly it was, the problem was with how the bill was designed. It simply just said, you know, you can't prosecute someone under the age of 10 unless it's for first or second degree murder. You know, a bipartisan group of representatives said, yeah, okay, that sounds good, but we want to see, you know, exactly what sort of process they would go through otherwise. Are they going to go through some sort of rehabilitation process with like a nonprofit or a state-run group? Are they going to be held accountable in some other way? Because the bill currently didn't have any sort of those processes outlined at all. So, yeah, a few of them actually said, like, hey, figure that out, bring it back, and sounds like something we could support. It only failed by one vote, so if they managed to flip someone, then it certainly has a path forward. The other thing to keep in mind too is that state, you know, officials basically said that the system isn't currently set up to process children as young as even 10 years old, really, in the judicial system with, you know, juvenile detention. They don't think that the current rehabilitation programs, group therapy, and other programs they have with these detention centers are really beneficial to children that young. Again, because of brain development, and also, you know, there are safety issues with older teenagers in those settings. So a whole lot of things to keep in mind. Like I said, there is an avenue for it, seemingly, if the bill can be reworked, and it's something we'll keep an eye on.
Okay, thanks for that, Jimmy. Sydney, talk to us about Ada County Highway District, because after Snowmageddon of 2017, the ACHD said that they, doubled or tripled their snowplows, but they're walking that number back now?
Yeah. So last week with the snow that we got, and this week with the snow that we got, snow plows are something that's really on people's mind as they venture out to go to work or their day-to-day activities. And so last week, Boise Dev reached out to Ada County because we had received questions from our readers asking what ACHD had done to prevent another 2017 style Snowmageddon type debacle. And when we reached out, we were told that ACHD in 2017 had 12 snowplows and now they have 43. So we reported that out. And I want to give a shout out to our sharp-eyed readers because some of them saw that and they said, I thought they had a lot more snowplows. And actually, some of us sent reporting done by Boise State Public Radio in 2017 that said that the district had 37 snowplows, not 12. So, yeah. So we reached back out to ACHD and said, hey, what can you tell us about this? And they looked around and tried and talked to a bunch of people in the district and figured out that yes, they did have 37 snowplows in 2017, not 12. And they said, we're not really sure where the number 12 came from. It's just something that's been said a lot and that we should have verified it with you guys before sharing it to you and the commission, etc. And also come to find out that they did start the season with 43 snowplows, but they've since outfitted a couple more of their pickup trucks with these blades. And so now they're up to 46 plows. So quite the difference. They didn't triple their snowplow numbers But they did get a few more, and they told us that they have also ordered some more dump trucks, and they'll be coming in the coming months and years. But yeah, that's kind of what happened.
Okay, well, thanks for that. So Mia, the governor of Idaho, Brad Little, recently led a trade mission to Mexico, and there was a lot of talk about potatoes. So how big of a trade partner is Mexico to Idaho?
Yeah. Thank you so much for your question. So Idaho, Mexico being, you know, right next to the U.S., it's a really important agricultural partner for Idaho. In 2022, Idaho ag exports were worth $167 million to Mexico, making it the state's second biggest trading partner for agriculture, just behind Canada. Mexico is also a top beer producer, and a really common ingredient in Mexican beers is barley, which is a top Idaho ag export. So, you know, a lot of Idaho ingredients make their way to Mexico, and potatoes are no exception.
So with that said, though, Mia, is it true, though, that Mexico banned fresh Idaho potatoes until 2022?
Yes. Yeah. So this is really interesting. So before June of 2022, fresh U.S. potatoes were only allowed within the first 26 kilometers of the U.S. border. That doesn't include frozen potatoes or dehydrated potatoes. Those could make their way all throughout Mexico, but fresh U.S. potatoes were left behind. So, you know, the Idaho Potato Commission, along with the Idaho Department of Agriculture, you know, being the top U.S. producer of potatoes, they definitely spearheaded efforts in, you know, pushing for Mexico to open up those restrictions. And they were, you know, they were successful doing so in June of 2022. And in the recent trade mission in November, Idaho Governor Brad Little, along with the Potato Commission and the Department of Agriculture, were really able to cultivate relationships with Mexican retailers that welcomed fresh Idaho potatoes. So it's a big win for Idaho, you know, because Idaho, they produce, fun fact, Idaho, I mean, this isn't a surprise to anybody, but Idaho is the leading potato producer in the U.S., selling 1.4 billion worth of potato crops.
Holy cow.
Yeah. And Washington is still in the millions, same with Oregon, but Idaho, we're in the billions. So, and also in 2023, Idaho had a record-breaking harvest of potatoes. So I spoke with the Department of Agriculture director, Chanel Tewalt, and she told me, you know, securing relationships in Mexico is so important for potato farmers, because in Idaho, if you don't have, you know, a secure outlet to send your potatoes, that can definitely take a financial toll on the energy and time and investment that potato farmers make. So, yeah, it was definitely a really fun story to write. Idaho potatoes have become like something that I regularly write about, and it's because it's so important to our farmers and the agricultural industry.
Well, I have to say, Mia, I had no idea though about this ban that was in place until 2022. Though, I mean, in 26 kilometers outside of the border, I mean, there's no way that Idaho could have exported its potatoes.
Yeah, and that ban, I don't know all the background, but from what I understand, that comes from just, you know, Mexico being hesitant with, you know, potential, you know, diseases or crop safety. And so finally being able to export Idaho potatoes and U.S. fresh potatoes into Mexico, you know, it makes a big difference to our farmers.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank all of you for joining us today. So appreciate your time. Our panelists today, Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Mia Maldonado, States Politics Reporter with the Idaho Capital Sun, our James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News, Sydney Kidd with Boise Dev, and Murphy Woodhouse, Mountain West News Bureau Reporter with Boise State Public Radio News. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
This new year, LifeKit wants to help you succeed. because everyone needs a little help being human.
It can seem so overwhelming. You're not alone.
Who can I commit to being?
If you want to do something, then just do it. Just take that first step.
Great advice every week. Listen to Life Kit from NPR.